Hi, I'm David Crow, and this is The Infectious Myth. Thank you for being a listener. If you have a comment or want to suggest a future guest, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can download the podcasts after our broadcast on iTunes and other podcast programs. Write to me if you have comments on the show or other suggestions. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until you contact me. On to today's topic. Mental illness is a topic I've covered a few times already, but definitely not enough. Even the term mental illness is problematic because it implies a disease that comes upon a person unawares rather than a dysfunctional reaction to life's circumstances, particularly overuse of recreational drugs or prescription drugs. If someone who's lost their job is in the middle of a divorce and who is drinking too much, are they depressed or just finding it impossible to pick up the pieces and move on? Does a soldier who's seen and done terrible things, who comes back and has awful dreams, is doing drugs every day and has a problem with anger, is he ill with PTSD or simply unable to handle the trauma that he's been through? Do these people need drugs or a supportive environment? My guest today is Robert Whitaker, a journalist who has an award for medical writing and a National Association for Science Writers Awards for Best Magazine Article. In 1998, he co-wrote a series on psychiatric research for the Boston Globe, who was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. His book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, won the 2010 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Best Investigative Journalism. He also wrote the earlier book, Mad in America. And there is now a vibrant website, madinamerica.com, which lists numerous authors who are writing about the dysfunctional psychiatry that has infected the Western world. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thanks for having me, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, and should I call you Bob? That seems to be...
Yeah, Bob's good.
Okay, Bob's good. Well, I'm very pleased to have you with me on the show today. How did you get interested in alternative or skeptical viewpoints on the treatment of mental illness in the United States?
Well, it was really a backdoor thing. When I was doing that series that you mentioned in the introduction for the Boston Globe on abuses of psychiatric patients, I had a completely conventional understanding of psychiatry at that time, and my understanding was that we were getting ever better at identifying the biological causes of mental disorders, that we knew they were due to chemical imbalances, and that we now had drugs that fixed those imbalances. So I started with an absolutely conventional understanding. And then what happened is while I was doing the research for that series, I came upon a couple of studies that belied that truth, so to speak.
Right.
One was a study done by Harvard researchers who reported in 1994 that outcomes for schizophrenia patients were actually getting worse in modern times, and they were now no better than they had been in the first 30 years of the 20th century, in other words, a century earlier. So that
right.
belied the story of progress. And then most notably, there were a couple studies done by the World Health Organization, one 2 years in length and one 5 years, which compared outcomes in three, quote, developing countries, India, Nigeria, and Colombia, with outcomes in the U.S. and six other, quote, developed countries. And each time they found that the outcomes for schizophrenia patients were much, much better in the poor countries, and specifically India and Nigeria. And they
right.
actually concluded that living in a developed country was a strong predictor you wouldn't have a good outcome. Now, this obviously, you know, upset things. And then most notably, when I looked into those studies, in the poor countries, they weren't keeping people on antipsychotic drugs, which was something I thought was absolutely essential. So that was the beginning of research that that made me begin to question what I thought I knew to be true.
And how can you define schizophrenia simply? Because it's a term that's used a lot, but I'm not sure even I know exactly what it means.
No one knows what the term means.
Okay.
It varies so much, okay? Here's the point of this in these studies. Going back to the Harvard one, you're probably not even comparing people. The Harvard study where they compared modern outcomes to outcomes from a group of patients 100 years earlier.
Right.
I mean, that term has been applied to different types of people. Now, interestingly, actually, it was being applied to much more seriously disturbed people in 1900 than in the modern era. So, if anything, you should see benefits today. But then in the World Health Organization studies, okay, these were studies in which the diagnosis was being done by Western investigators, in other words, by World Health Organization investigators, and they were applying it to a group of people with a similar group of symptoms. Whether so at least you were comparing in these different countries people with like symptoms, and yet they were calling schizophrenia. So I wasn't challenging the diagnosis, but there's plenty of reason to challenge the diagnosis, because even within mainstream psychiatry today, they'll admit there's no such thing as a discrete disorder called schizophrenia, and it's a broad term applied to a lot of different symptoms.
Right. I remember seeing kind of an undercover video of somebody who went to see different psychiatrists, and he described his symptoms in the same language in each time, and came away from different psychiatrists with dramatically different diagnoses.
If you talk to any patients, they often have had four or five diagnoses. So, I mean, it shows how fungible.
Right, because there's no... Even though they talk about chemical imbalances, there is no chemical test for any mental disorder. Like, nobody can look for an enzyme, a hormone, a brain chemical, a blood chemical, and say, oh, that means you have this mental disorder.
Yeah, that's right. There's no biological marker for major disorders. So in the absence of that, it becomes, the American Psychiatric Association sets up certain constructs which say this disorder will be, diagnosed if they have certain symptoms. But the symptoms themselves are so vague that it leads to, one person will see bipolar, another person will see schizophrenia, another one person will see schizoaffective, and another will see, it just goes on and on.
Right. And that's in the DSM that you're referring to, right?
So the diagnostic manual put together by the American Psychiatric Association, it has hundreds of diagnoses. But there are diagnoses made not on the basis, as you say, by biological markers, but just whether a person has supposedly the characteristic symptoms of that disorder. And the symptoms themselves can be questionable of, do they have the symptom or do not? Say, for are they sleeping well? What does that mean? So.
Right. I did a couple of shows on Ebola, and one of the symptoms of the modern Ebola is a severe headache. And I was thinking, you can't diagnose a severe headache, which I understand is not a mental illness, but it's the same kind of thing, that if I say I have a severe headache, you really have no way to know if I'm telling the truth or not. Or it may be that I have a really low pain threshold, and for me a minor headache is a severe headache, and some more macho guy says, oh, no, I don't really have a headache, and it's really a splitting headache. And with psychiatric illness, it's even worse, because you're asking, very subjective questions about people's lives and what they think about different things.
There's no question about that. One person's severe headache, I couldn't agree more, it's a great metaphor. One person's severe headache is to another person who's going to be described as mild. And then besides that, you have the question is, there can be many different causes of headaches, right? So and you have the same sort of utter lack of precision in psychiatric diagnosis. I mean, not the same. You have such an utter lack of precision of diagnoses in terms of the it's not in, you know what they say in medicine? For a diagnostic manual, it has to be both reliable and valid. Reliable means you go to two different doctors with the same symptoms, you get the same diagnosis.
Right.
That doesn't happen within psychiatry. Valid means that the diagnoses refer to some discrete disorder, discrete disease. And in fact, the diagnoses in DSM manual haven't been validated in that regard.
Well, yeah, I mean, if there's no chemical or physical symptoms, if it's all based on subjective criteria, then you have no way of knowing that even two people with the same symptoms actually have the same underlying condition. And actually, here's a big question. Is there such a thing as mental illness, or is that term itself part of the problem?
Well, listen, the term is certainly part of the problem, because what we've done now is we've said any sort of psychiatric distress is a, quote, a mental illness, and that's clearly ludicrous. Listen, I think there are some conditions where you do have an underlying biology to it. We may not have found it, but there are some people, I think, that maybe have psychotic symptoms or who may, in fact, have something wrong biologically. And this shouldn't surprise us. I mean, we do know that there are diseases that can lead to, psychotic moments or mania, et cetera. We do know that...
Well, poisoning, like with lead or mercury, can cause a lot of psychiatric symptoms.
Right. So I just don't want us to get in this thing that there can never be, like, biological causes, when clearly, in my opinion, we're mind-body machines, and if the body is not healthy, you can certainly have disruptions of the mind. But on the other hand, the thing that is, I think, also you're getting at that is so incredibly misleading is the way the American Psychiatric Association has constructed its diagnoses. You're just not supposed to be uncomfortable with life, right? If you're anxious, that's not good. If you're if you're filled with grief, that's not good. If you're a kid who's not altogether fond of sitting in your chair for 5 hours, that's not good. It's clearly not a mental illness to not want to sit in your chair for 5 hours, or sometimes to be anxious.
Have that.
so many of us do. So, I mean, yeah. I think this is part of the problem, is that we've used this language to encompass psychiatric distress of a wide type, and the understanding is that it is, there's something biological, that there's something pathological, and it's so often the case. You had a beautiful description. I thought, sometimes it's just people adjusting to really difficult life events in ways that aren't very, that are difficult for them.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems I see is that if you sort of say, okay, you're depressed, but in actual fact, the cause for your depression is because you feel like you're in a dead-end job, and you feel out of touch with your family, and you don't have any energy, and all those things. Well, there is a problem there that could be fixed. You could change your job. You could start exercising. You could, maybe have counseling with your spouse or whatever, if that's a problem. I mean, there's things that you could do if you say, it's not, I don't have a disease, I have a life that's not going well, and I need to change something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is part of the tragedy of this modern model, is it's so mechanistic and so, it robs people of any sort of agency, because, you're depressed, well, that's because you have low serotonin. It's not because, as you said, you might be in a dead-end job, or maybe you're going through a divorce or something else. And it takes away the sense that, depression maybe, and sometimes, is a sign like, I need to do something different in my life. And maybe it means to be, I have to get a different relationship, or I have to quit this job and get a job that I find more meaningful. So, and then, sometimes life is tough.
I think
it just deals you setbacks.
Right. It definitely, there's a ton of things that can go wrong. And, I mean, I also feel this with returning soldiers. Like, nobody, really wants to talk about what they saw. The soldiers might not want to talk about it, and yet they might not be able to deal with, the horrible things that they saw and maybe some of the things that they did. So we call it PTSD, and we can put them on drugs, and, we can hope that they can go on and live a normal life. But there are so many soldiers who never do live a normal life because of what happened. And maybe we're not doing them a favor by putting a broad brush PTSD.
I think we're very much not doing them a favor. In fact, I think calling them to say they have PTSD and then medicating them, it's like compounding the difficulties for them, being medicated, et cetera. And clearly it also, like, excuses society, right? It's like society doesn't have any responsibility for sending the young men and women over there to be in these situations where they experience this, these horrible events,
right,
et cetera. So we just say, that person is traumatized by it, as if it's their pathology. And
it's not that much better than, like, the First World War when we called them cowards and shot them. I mean, at least now we're not criminalizing this behavior, but by putting it all in one bucket, we're trying to avoid us as a society saying, what are we doing to young men by sending them to wars?
Yeah, exactly. And then we're not saying what we should do as a society if we decide to do this. What do we need to help them return and get their lives back? I mean, in a full-bodied
way. Yeah, I mean, it's
way.
Two questions. What do we do to the people, to help the people who've been damaged, and how do we prevent so many soldiers coming back damaged in the future? Like, one solution would be to have fewer wars. That would be kind of a radical solution.
That would be a great solution for the United States sometimes, I think. And, you know, also if you see what happened in the United States, the people who volunteered, like, after 2001 and, you know, went over to Iraq, they ended up having to go back again and again and again. Whereas if you go back to World War II, they went and they came. I mean, my father was World War II. He went and he came back. This thing where you come back and then have to keep going back, it's just got to be extraordinarily impossible for the person.
Yes. Yeah, and I think wars are different. I think in World War II, there was a feeling like we're going to go there. The people want to be liberated. We're going to do it and come back, and that's basically what happened. But with Iraq, it's not clear that people want the soldiers there. Many certainly don't, and it's not clear that there's ever going to be an end to the war. Like, it must be a very depressing environment to be in to start with, let alone, you know, seeing people blown apart in front of you, seeing your friends blown apart, seeing children blown apart. All those things must be really psychologically damaging, and you know, we certainly, it's uncomfortable to talk to the soldiers, and I'm sure many of the soldiers don't want to talk about it either.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Very cool.
One thing I noted in an article you wrote in March, you noted that antipsychotic drugs do not reduce psychotic symptoms, or there was research by Martin Harrow who found that. And you also mentioned that there's research in the 60s and 70s that found negative results with antipsychotics. So why are we using these drugs today when they're not working?
Yeah, what you see in the research literature is sort of paradoxical. I mean, you'll see that when people first come in, that sometimes the antipsychotics will work over the short term, okay, in terms of knocking down psychotic symptoms better than placebo. And then here's where the delusion comes in. Once a person goes on the drug, their brain adapts to the presence of the drug. And then when they go off, it is clear they're at severe risk of relapse, psychotic symptoms returning. And so we perceive that as the disease returning. We don't perceive it as, well, maybe that's, you know, a withdrawal effect. And what you see in the, and such as in the some of those earlier 1960 and 1970 studies, or the Martin Harrow study, is that if you start out with people either medicated or non-medicated, over a longer period of time, it's the medicated group after two, three, five, 10 years that is more likely to remain psychotic than the unmedicated group. And in the Martin Harrow study, which is the best long-running study we've ever had done, he's a psychologist at the University of Illinois, and he's followed people now for 25 years. Those who stayed on medication, I'm talking about schizophrenia patients, about 70% were still psychotic, you know, at 10, 15, and 20-year follow-ups, whereas only for those who got off meds, only about 25% were still psychotic at those later follow-ups. So
I mean,
that's
shocking. The first statistic is shocking, because how can we have a drug that when you stay on it, like only 25% of the people are, quote, cured, even though you're staying on it? I mean, that's pretty bad advertising.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really does show the... I mean, and they've seen this in other types of studies. The Cady study found similar sort of problems. Yeah, so this is the reason you give people antipsychotics long-term. It's supposed to diminish their psychosis. But if 70% are remaining psychotic, it means the drug, it's just not working well, right? It's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. And this is paradoxical, because doctors see that it works short-term. They see people get bad when they come off. But now when they try to understand what's going on long-term, they've even come up for a biological explanation, or at least a hypothesis, for why the drugs make people more psychotic over the long-term.
Well, yeah, that is interesting, and it's kind of, I can see why doctors would get trapped in this belief, because nobody wants to admit that pharmaceutical drugs have addictive properties, which is essentially what's happening, is that when you go off the antipsychotics, it's like withdrawing from heroin or something. That you're having withdrawal symptoms, which are your, quote, disease, And therefore, the doctor logically concludes that, well, you need these drugs.
Right. But yeah, go ahead, Zane.
Go ahead.
No, I think you're at something, a point really important here. And there's even a paper written by Stephen Hyman in 1996. He calls it a paradigm for understanding psychotropic drugs. And he says, with illegal drugs, we know your brain adapts to the presence of the drug, and then when you come off, you're going to have withdrawal symptoms. We say that.
Right.
But then we don't say that when people are coming off legal drugs. We say the disease returning. But he says, in fact, that it's the same thing. Your brain is adapted to the presence of the drug. And that's where the delusion comes in. We attribute that the return of symptoms or new symptoms to a return of the disease when you've been on a legally prescribed psychotropic drug. But it's clear that a lot of what you're seeing is withdrawal symptoms.
And so if people do want to get off psychiatric drugs, I mean, one message is that they should not go cold turkey. I mean, unless they have a really strong constitution, that they need to gradually reduce the dose, or they're likely to suffer very severe mental problems.
Yeah, that's certainly true with antipsychotics, and a lot of people have trouble with benzodiazepines in that way and antidepressants in that way. Yeah, the message seems to be that if you're going to try to taper off, you need to do it gradually. B, you need to do it with the understanding that even if you do it gradually, you might get some return of symptoms for a long period of time that are withdrawal related. Even if you do it gradually, you're still at risk. And then three, if you're going to do it, it's really nice to have someone who understands what you may be going through and can provide you support, because really what we've seen now is once you've been on drugs for a fairly long period of time and your brain is adapted to the presence of that psychiatric drug, it is hard to come off.
Right, and if you go to your doctor, they're almost certainly going to say, get back on the drugs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I get emails from people all the time saying, where do I go for help to taper from medications? And it's really hard to find the practitioners that will help them do that. So often it's people turning to other people have been through it for help.
Yes, and I mean, the thing that distinguishes psychiatry is the ability to prescribe psychiatric drugs. So if a psychiatrist is basically a specialist in prescribing drugs, you're not going to get many alternatives from them. I don't know how many psychiatrists have a variety of tools in their tool bag, or how many basically just are deciding which drug their patients should get.
Well, this goes back again to the 1980. So in 1980 is when the American Psychiatric Association published the third edition of its diagnostic manual, the DSM. And then this is the moment they adopt a disease model. Well, the moment they do that, they basically start leaving talk therapy to others, psychologists, social workers. And now what's their product? I mean, what do? They become prescribers. So many in the United States, that's mostly what they do, is they prescribe drugs. So given that fact, if this is my product, it's going to be pretty hard for me to say that my product stinks and is making you worse, right? I can't do that. I can't even believe it, or else I won't be able to continue prescribing the drugs. So
the question is, if I come in with a problem, then the question is not, should I be on drugs, but it's like, well, maybe you're on the wrong drug. Maybe we can change your drug. Maybe we can change the dose, something like that. But it's not going to be, oh, you need to go talk to somebody.
No, you see this over and over again. People go on one drug, they don't do well on it, or maybe they get worse on it, and instead of then taking that drug away and to see what might happen, they add a second drug and then a third drug, and sometimes you're on an antidepressant and an anti-anxiety drug, and you get these cocktails. And which the irony is, this is seen as a psychiatrist sort of, trying to find just the right mix, whereas from the outside you can see it really as an example of a failed paradigm of care. Why does someone need to be on 3-4 drugs?
It's the danger of specialization, because if you go to a psychologist, you're probably going to get talk therapy because they can't prescribe drugs.
That's true.
It sort of depends how you enter the system. I mean, a psychologist might say, look, I can't help you. You're going to have to go see a psychiatrist. But chances are they're going to try to talk to you about your problems. And if you go to a psychiatrist, they're going to diagnose you with psychosis or schizophrenia or something and put you on drugs. What are some of the side effects of these drugs? Because they are pretty potent compounds.
Well, that we could have about a two-hour conversation about
okay.
side effects of the drugs. I mean, it depends on the different classes of drugs. But really, when you dig into the side effects, what you need to look at is will there be physical side effects? And there will be. So if with the antipsychotics, for example, the newer ones like olanzapine, risperdal and stuff, you may see a lot of metabolic problems, cholesterol problems, diabetes, obesity, that sort of thing. You can also get Parkinsonian symptoms with the antipsychotics. You can get something called tardive dyskinesia over time, which is a sign your basal ganglia is becoming dysfunctional. But really, it's like
that?
Permanent Parkinson's, really. I mean, you'll see people with constant motor tics, that sort of thing. And it really is a sign that the basal ganglia, which is the part of the brain that controls motor movement, is becoming dysfunctional. But I think for your audience to think about side effects, think about them of different domains. So you will find some physical side effects, sexual dysfunction, what we talked about, metabolic problems, et cetera. So that's one domain of functions you want to investigate if you're on these medications. A second domain of functioning is emotional difficulties. So, some drugs may cause mania, have a risk of causing mania, like the antidepressants do. The antipsychotics may, in fact, cause an emotional lethargy, a sort of "I don't give a damn about life" feeling.
Right.
You'll see a lot of different some drugs clearly can increase the risk of violence because of what's called an akathisic reaction. So you have emotional side effects. You have physical side effects, and sometimes you can have cognitive side effects as well. Your memory won't be as good. Your problem solving won't be as good, that sort of thing. So what I really think when we talk about adverse effects from psychiatric drugs, you need to think about it's going to have these drugs affect us broadly, physically, emotionally, cognitively, and you should try to flesh out what those known side effects are.
Right, and given the research that they're not terribly effective. I mean, that's a pretty high burden of side effects to take. But it's kind of like you're trapped because if you can't break through the barrier of withdrawal from the drugs, you're stuck on them. And you probably believe that they're helping you because every time you try to get off, you just feel worse.
Yeah, I think this is why going on the drugs in the first place is such a profound thing. So you come to a person with a problem, right, and you want some relief from that problem, and then you say, okay, this drug may help that, may do that over the next 3-4 weeks. But then that initial relief may come at a pretty high long-term cost because, once you're on, it can be hard to get off, and then which can lead you to stay on the drug, and then if you look at long-term use of the medication, so often you see you see actually greater chronicity of the target symptom, and then you see these side effects as well. So if you go back to that initial moment of prescription, you can see that going on a drug is a pretty profound thing to do, and you're sort of sending your life down a different track, and given, as you say, often the benefit over placebo is quite small. Maybe we as a society, in fact, should be encouraging other alternative sort of initial responses.
Right. I mean, and what are techniques for dealing with people with, quote, schizophrenia, or even if we can't quite define it, there's, a list of symptoms that some people do have. What are some of the non-drug techniques that have proven to be more effective in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with this particular group of patients said to be, psychotic, which then will often then lead to a diagnosis of schizophrenia, we can look to how it's being treated and has been treated now for more than 2 decades in northern Finland. And they're in an area called the Western Lapland, and they rethought their use of antipsychotic drugs in 1992, and what they decided is, with new patients, with first episode patients, we'll try to provide them with a lot of psychosocial resources, but we'll try to avoid putting them on antipsychotics.
Right.
And we'll see if we can get them through that break without starting this drug-treated process. Now,
right.
if that's not working, after 3-4 weeks, they will use a low dose of antipsychotic, and then they'll use it for a time, but then they'll try to wean them off. And the point is they're trying to minimize long-term use. And there, only about 20% of patients stay on the drugs long-term. I'm talking about first-episode psychotic patients. And they now have by far the best outcomes in the Western world. And what they've found that if they can manage with intense psychosocial care that episode of psychosis when it first breaks, it often just then resolves after, say, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and people then start to get their life back. And it is intensive psychosocial care, a lot of talk therapy, but also a lot of family therapy, a lot of work to get, as people get better, to get them back in school or working, at, you know, sort of
right.
to rebuild meaningful lives. So it's
right.
a commitment up front.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's a lot of work for everybody in the short term with a big long-term reward, whereas putting somebody on drugs in the short term is no work at all, but if it creates a dysfunctional life, then it's a huge loss. And I believe in your book you described how there are so many people with, quote, mental illness who end up on disability.
Right.
And that sort of says that the drugs aren't working, because if the drugs are working, I mean, the message I get if I read the mainstream media is that, you know, if people will get on the right drugs, then they'll be back at work and nobody will know that they're, quote, mentally ill. Because their drug has their symptoms under control. But what you describe is a lot of these people don't go back to work. They end up on disability.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think you've described what our common belief is quite precisely. The belief is, though, these medications help people lead a normal, functional lives. But what you see, and let's just look at since 1987. In 1987, there were 1.25 million adults in the United States on disability due to mental illness.
Right.
In other words, that's why they got declared eligible. Well, we're well over 4.5 million today, so it's it's been almost a fourfold increase. And why did I pick 1987? Well, that was the year that Prozac came to market, and that was the first of the second generation psychiatric drugs. So we got SSRI antidepressants said to be so better than the old tricyclics. Then we got new antipsychotics, et cetera. And it's also during this time when we've really embraced this idea of that diagnosis is helpful and drug treatment is helpful. So generally when you get real illnesses that are treated, more and more treated with effective drugs, you'll see the burden of that illness go down in society, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the measure of effective medicine. You diagnose
right.
people, you get it treated, and then the burden
right.
of that problem becomes less. Here,
right.
exactly the opposite has happened. The more we diagnose, and the more we use these drugs, we see this astonishing rise in disability. Now, you're seeing this in country after country that has adopted this paradigm of care. It's not unique to the United States. It's not unique to Canada. And then then the question becomes, well, why? And what you see in the research literature is two things. One, over the long term, if you take depressed patients who go on medication for those who don't, it's the unmedicated group that will have higher employment rates and lower disability rates over the long term. Same with psychotic disorders. Same with anxiety disorders. So what you see is that our own research is showing us that over the long term, that being on the medication increases the risk that you'll become disabled by the initial disorder. The other thing that you see in the research literature is that, particularly with antidepressants and stimulants, say with antidepressants, you have a milder depression. You go on, which in the past would have resolved itself on its own with time. Now you go on an antidepressant. Some people will have a manic episode. Once they have the manic episode on the antidepressant, they get diagnosed with bipolar. Once they're diagnosed with bipolar, they're hit with a number of drugs, and now they have a high risk of becoming disabled. So what you see there is a pathway that can take someone with a milder problem and end up with a more severe diagnosis, and then they're a career, quote, mental patient. You can see this with kids with ADHD, too. Some kids placed on stimulants will have a psychotic episode. They'll move into a bipolar diagnosis, and once that happens, they're seen as, you know, having a chronic lifelong illness. So that's one of the reasons we're seeing this rise in disability rates as well.
Right. You described in one of the articles, one of your recent articles, a Canadian study that talked about the Quebec government, which started to cover more psychiatric medication.
Right, for stimulants. This was I don't understand all the methodology here, but it's really interesting. So the province of Quebec, as you said, made a decision in the 90s sometimes that in essence, made the population more willing to take, you know, medications. And so the prescribing of stimulants in that province grew rather dramatically, more than in other provinces in Canada, stimulants for ADHD. Anyway, they looked at about how'd that play out over the next 15 years. And this were researchers at several universities, including at Princeton. And they found that it was a negative for Quebec. In other words, you saw that increased the likelihood that kids would not do so well in school. Actually, parent-child relationships got worse. It was negative on every domain of functioning. So that's like an experiment where you see was making a change, a policy change that led to more children being diagnosed and more with ADHD and more children being placed on stimulants. Did that benefit the society as a whole? And they found it was precisely the opposite.
And has Quebec changed their policy, or are they?
I'm not following it, but I'd be very surprised. I haven't followed what Quebec did after this study came out. But one of the things that you see over and over again in this field of medicine, which is so surprising, is they'll get a negative result like that and nothing will be done. We had our own study in the United States called the MTA study, which was a long-term study of outcomes with stimulants for ADHD. It was meant to guide policy. And what did they find? They found that at the end of 3 years, 6 years, and 8 years, the medicated kids were doing worse on all domains of functioning, except maybe it was math or something at the six or something. But it was a negative. So in response to that, did we say, whoops, we maybe shouldn't be medicating these kids long-term? Nope, it didn't change a bit. And in fact, that message was basically kept from the public that when we tested this long-term, the stimulants were not found to provide a benefit.
And I think the mainstream media plays a huge role in maintaining this illusion about medical treatment, because when I read it, it's almost like a robot could write what they're writing. Is that if there is somebody who has an issue, their problems, like somebody murders somebody out of character or does something like that, and it's mentioned in the newspaper, it's like they just went off their medication or they were being treated for a mental illness with the implication that it's the mental illness that's causing the issues, not the side effects of the psychiatric drugs. They impose a very, very simplistic dogma on the whole mental illness business, leading to more treatment.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. The media reporting of mental illness is just horrific, just terrible. And I think it goes back to this idea that the media is supposed, when you're a science journalist, so you come up as a journalist, right? And you know when you cover politics, politicians, et cetera, that you expect them to lie to you, okay, so you can be critical. When you cover businesses, often you can expect them to be manipulating you because obviously they have a financial end. So you're supposed to be critical. You're supposed to go to the documents. You're supposed to check things out that are told to you. But when you move over into the science medical sphere as a reporter, it's like, oh, your job now is to translate what the experts say, and you can't possibly be a critical reporter anymore. And so the experts in psychiatry decided to tell a certain story that it's so easy, actually, when you start digging into the scientific literature to see it's not true. But nevertheless, the media just becomes like a puppet and says, you know, these absolutely facile things that are out of sync with reality.
I think you have it right. The media doesn't want to feel that they're just completely a mouthpiece, but they feel that their job is, they're talking about a field that's very complicated that the average person can't understand, so their job is to translate it into English. not to ask questions about how much money is a psychiatrist making from the drug company for which they're promoting their drug. Like, you rarely see information on the conflicts of interest of some of these powerful people.
No, exactly. And yet, if you really look into this, you'll find that by the end of the 1990s, virtually every prominent American psychiatrist had a tie to a pharmaceutical company, serving as consultants, advisors, that sort of thing, speakers. And you
right.
can be sure that that affected what they told told the public. And in fact, both the pharmaceutical companies and the APA for a number of years used to do media training workshops telling, getting their academic psychiatrists and others, here's what you should be telling the media. So it was like training them to tell a certain story. But, the public isn't told that.
Yes. I think the public has no idea. I mean, we're trained, and it's not just the mainstream media in the terms of the news or newspapers and things like that, but it's also the portrayal of doctors in entertainment as well. It used to drive me nuts where, on a police show or a detective show, that the psychiatrist would always be able to accurately diagnose what somebody was going to do, what they've done, be able to determine why they did it. They had this incredibly precise diagnosis and predictive capabilities that I knew was like completely false.
Yeah, any studies that look about whether psychiatrists can predict who's going to be violent or who's going to do this or that, it just that they never that the predictive abilities are very poor.
Yes, and yet in entertainment, it kind of makes sense from an entertainment point of view. I mean, you want something dramatic. So if the psychiatrist says, he's going to kill, then you'd better go pick him up because it's going to happen. But in reality, when people with mental illness do kill, it's just not very clear. Like this recent case in New York, I mean, the guy was clearly a problem, but his last violence was an attempt to commit suicide. So it's not clear that people could have predicted, that far in advance that he was going to do anything bad.
Yeah, I think this is so. This goes back to this early part of the conversation when we said, what is mental illness? Well, I mean, if you want to say it encompasses all disturbed behavior, well, regardless of what is going on in that person's life, environmentally, et cetera, meaningful and that sort of thing. Well, then, of course, anybody who commits a horrid crime is going to be seen as mentally ill because that's how you're defining mental illness. But we take it to mean the person has some known illness that's causing it. It's the language in this sort of sphere of our society is so imprecise and so misleading that we can't even think clearly about these things.
Well, that's actually legally very significant because, in America, which still unfortunately has a death penalty, you're not supposed to execute somebody who's mentally ill. But if
right.
you can't define mental illness, I mean, you could either say that everybody who goes around killing people is mentally ill and therefore nobody should be executed, or you can say, well, we really can't tell, so we should just forget about whether somebody's mentally ill or not and execute them anyway. But it seems kind of an arbitrary thing. If you can get a psychiatrist to come in and say, oh, yeah, this person's schizophrenic, then they don't get executed. And if you can't find a psychiatrist to do it, they do.
Well, yeah, and often you'll have experts on different sides of the coin here. The standard in the United States isn't actually are they mentally ill, it's are they insane. And insane
okay.
means, I think, you're not able to appreciate the wrongness of your actions, something like that. So it's not just mental illness, but it. Yeah, and then you'll find that. Listen, you'll get four psychiatrists who say that this person qualifies as insane. That the other two say they don't. I mean, it is certainly somewhat arbitrary. That's for sure. And then if
right.
you take these things that like. We have a lot of we have a lot of school killings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me who would do that if they weren't pretty insane? But by that I mean is, clearly you're quite disturbed if you go into a school and start shooting people. And yet, what are we going to say that, I mean, you just see how once you do start going down this path and start saying that certain people aren't responsible for their actions, where you draw the line to me is, it becomes really, really, really hard.
Yeah, I have a similar feeling. I mean, you could have two identical school shooters and one's insane and one's not, but I mean, I look at it as like that, it's just insane to walk into school and start shooting kids. It's like something that 99.99% of the population couldn't conceive of doing.
Exactly.
One thing that's always present when we talk about mental illness is recreational drug use. And one thing I hear more and more commonly is that recreational drug use only precedes mental illness because people are self-medicating. But my feeling is that maybe the use of recreational drugs causes, you know, what can be described as mental illness. I mean, have you thought about that issue?
Yeah, sure. You know, you're of course absolutely right. It's amazing to me that this again is like a third rail. We don't like to speak about this. But just take the evidence for daily marijuana use or regular marijuana use when you're 17, 18, 19, 20. There's no question that increases your risk of having a bipolar episode. It's quite clear, and there's a lot of data on it. And it just seems to me that should be at least part of what we admit is true when we talk about, say, the use of cannabis in our society. But same thing, there's other drugs, of course, that clearly hallucinogens can do it, you know.
Right.
They clearly can cause psychotic episodes. And in fact, if you really look today at people who have a first episode of psychosis or mania and find out how many of them have been on illicit psychiatric drugs, it's real, real high. And here's the thing is, this idea that they would have done it anyway because they're just self-medicating, you know, the distress.
Right.
Well, here's what the evidence is quite clear, is that without that exposure, far fewer of them, such people who may have some difficulties in life, would have had a psychotic episode or would have had a manic episode. That's one. And two, you can take people who are really just okay. You know, they're not really struggling with any, you know, interior anxiety that makes them smoke marijuana, but they just start smoking marijuana every day, and next thing you know, they've had a psychotic episode. In other words, there's no evidence of self-medicating. Rather, what you see is the kids getting involved in it is because just what kids do today. So,
well, listen, I mean,
we are awash in these illicit drugs in the United States, and clearly they are a factor.
Right. I mean, it's probably a rare teenager who gets through their teen years without trying something, ecstasy at a party or marijuana or, I mean, the popular one, of course, is alcohol, which is
right.
Our society is awash in. And some of those, I mean, some kids are just fine. You know, they take a pill occasionally and nothing really bad happens, but some really like it or really get hooked easily, and then they start to get problems in school and probably not telling anybody about how much drugs they're doing, and then they get diagnosed with a mental disorder, and then our solution is to put them on more drugs.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think you've very concisely outlined what's happening to many, many people in our societies, young people.
Yes. You described in something on your website that last year you spoke at the National Institute for the Mentally Ill, known as NAMI, and
right.
And then it sounds like you were almost accused of murder afterwards. Like, what's going
right.
on there?
Yeah, this is really interesting, you know. So I wrote this book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, which looked at how do these medications affect long-term outcomes. And I mean, what you find in the scientific literature is that they're not leading to good long-term outcomes, at least in the whole. So that was a threat to a lot of powerful interests. Now, the National Alliance for Mentally Ill has been a group, an organization that for many, many decades has really been emphasizing the need to take medications if you have, any sort of diagnosis that is with a psychotic disorder. So, and they, by the way, have received money from the pharmaceutical companies to help promote that idea. Anyway, so I got invited to give a talk there, and which was quite remarkable, actually. And there was some people at NAMI that were very, very unhappy that I had been invited. So I gave my talk, and anybody who had been at this talk would hear just what we just heard on the radio, which was, yeah, they can be of relief over the short term, and B, once you're on them, it's really, really hard to come off and can be really perilous. So, and I've given this talk many, many times, and I've never had someone come away thinking that they should go off their drugs. You know, maybe they want to start a talk to people about that possibility, but maybe it goes away with understanding the peril. Anyway, about 3 days later, someone who's very much associated with forced medication runs this anonymous blog saying that their child had listened to me, their adult son, not their child, he was supposed to be like 30, listened to me at the meeting, came home, threw away his drugs, and was now missing. And the blog, as you said, it said Whitaker has blood on his hands, and they had a picture of someone who'd done a famous painting of an assassin. I forget which painting it is. So, yeah, that was nice to have on the Internet, and now that's been used against me many, many times, that to even invite me is dangerous. The irony is I'm pretty sure the whole thing was fake. It never happened.
So there was no son who went missing and went off their drugs?
No, this was an anonymous blog. And then when I asked NAMI, do you know who this person is? No. Did you get a complaint about this? No. I even asked the person who wrote published the blog, Pete Early, do you know who this person is? No. And all we heard is supposedly the kid then showed up and was now okay. This all happened too fast. And the other thing was, I had been warned before. There was a group that was trying to prevent me to speak.
Right.
And I got some documents. This is called the Treatment Advocacy Center. Was saying that, hey, we should be watching where he's speaking. We've got to counter him. Well, Pete Early is associated with that group for Treatment for Advocacy Center. And you really think that 3 days after I speak, someone threw away his drugs and is suddenly missing? In other words, it was like an advertising thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a way to discredit him. It doesn't happen that fast.
Yeah. That just sounds crazy. But I mean, it sounds like. But I mean, these people.
And all anonymous.
I mean,
remember, no one ever stepped forward and said, "I'm that person." Never.
I know of several instances similar to this, and I always wonder. I mean, are these people directly being paid by pharmaceutical companies? I mean, you just don't know who they are, what their motivation is. Like, why would somebody? Like, even a psychiatrist, why would a psychiatrist set up a fake blog and start posting fake stories to try to discredit somebody else? It sounds like somebody who has a direct financial benefit in making sure that your message doesn't get...
I'm not sure how much of this is... Well, I mean, there's this group called the Treatment Advocacy Center that's just a big lobbyist organization for increasing outpatient commitment in the United States. And I don't know their funding. I don't know if they get funding from pharmaceutical companies. I'd be surprised if they didn't.
And you were talking about forced medication as well?
So Treatment Advocacy Center has been advocating for laws that require people living in the community to take antipsychotics. And they've been very successful. I think we have something like 45 states now that have what's called assisted outpatient treatment laws, which means you're under a court order. Often to take an antipsychotic drug. So in order to promote that agenda, which certainly serves pharmaceutical industry interests as well, you have to be able to show that this is helpful for the person, right, that they need this medication.
Right.
And then I come along and say, hey, wait a minute, well, look at the long-term outcomes. We see much better outcomes in a different with people who are getting off medication. That becomes a threat to their whole story, their whole agenda. Mm-hmm. And basically, then they need to, you know, try to kill the messenger, and that's what that whole thing was about.
They have a separate financial conflict because they have these institutions set up to do the monitoring, I presume.
Well, they just, you know, they have money. They get lobbying money for it. Treatment Advocacy Center doesn't actually get payments now to do the monitoring, I don't really, it would be hard to understand the motive other than I know some of the people behind it, you know, have had children they wanted to be medicated and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that if you had a child who went off the rails and you really wanted them on psychiatric drugs and it didn't work out and the child kept going off them, that you might become very strident in your views, but that doesn't mean that your views are right. I mean, it could be that the child, quite likely the child's problem was that they were doing a lot of drugs and, you know, you're not really
right.
addressing
it. Yeah, and you're also not addressing, like, civil liberties issues, that sort of thing. And do these assisted outpatient treatment orders really work? Do they lead to better outcomes? That sort of thing. You know, it just becomes
a mess. Yeah, like when these laws are written, there's never, you know, like, let's keep monitoring the outcomes, and the law will be automatically canceled if the outcomes go negative. That's never included. Once it's law, it's law.
Exactly. And it's interesting that in England, the person who was the big advocate, a researcher for assisted outpatient treatment, in other words, for laws mandating treatment in the community, now has changed because he did research and he found it didn't produce a benefit.
Yeah.
But that's in the UK. Unfortunately, we don't hear that sort of thing in the US.
Yes. Well, we're coming towards the end of our hour, and I've really enjoyed this discussion, even though, you know, it's a pretty heavy subject, and it's a lot of people's lives are being messed up by, quote, mental illness and by side effects of medications. So I appreciate you sharing your extensive knowledge with my audience.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, David. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I would definitely recommend, you've written two books, right? Mad in America.
On this subject, Mad in America and then Anatomy of an Epidemic.
Yeah, and I've read both of those books, and I can strongly recommend that people read them. They're not highly technical, and it really certainly helped complete this. I mean, I was already starting to question things when I started to read the books, but they really gave me a lot more information that really helped me understand what was going wrong with the treatment of mental illness in America and in the entire world.
Well, that's nice to hear, so I really appreciate your kind words.
Yes, well, thank you. I appreciate you spending the hour with me.
All right, thanks so much.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
And I'd just like to finish with one feedback from Josh in Los Angeles, who said, I'm really enjoying your Infectious Myth podcast. And please send me your feedback through Facebook, email, Twitter. I really enjoy hearing from you. And there are some discussions occurring on the Facebook page, so I encourage you to get in there and start talking about this and participating in the conversation. Until next week, thank you for listening to The Infectious Myth. Bye-bye.